Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for October 15th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, testing improves memory, advances in nanomedicines, and how the body signals white blood cells to respond to injury. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about pessimistic dogs from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
More than 100 years ago, psychologist William James noted that a curious peculiarity of our memory is that things are impressed better by active than by passive repetition. For James, active repetition meant that if we want to memorize something, say, from a book, then it pays better to wait and recollect it by an effort within than it does to look at the book again. For Mary Pick, in a paper in this week's Science, that active repetition means testing yourself.
So there are hundreds of experiments that have demonstrated that testing is good for memory. So it's somewhat surprising that we don't really know why.
To try to find out why, at least for one particular type of memorization, the kind of paired word memorization often done in learning a foreign language, Pick and her co-author Catherine Rawson first taught study participants to use what are called mediators or keywords.
So if a student is learning Swahili and they have the word wingo in the English translation cloud, what can they do to help them remember? And basically, all that this entails is coming up with an English word that can link to both the Swahili word and the English target. So an effective keyword might be the word wing, because wing sounds like wingo, and can then be related to cloud by imagining that birds have wings and fly in clouds.
After they learned to use these mediators, some of the participants would restudy the Swahili-English pairs of words, and some of the participants would do that and also test themselves. Then, a week later, everyone was tested. The result? The participants who had tested themselves were far better at recalling the correct translations than those who had just restudied. Study author Mary Pick says that the practice testing helped those participants create more effective mediators.
So we know that there's two components to effective mediators, and that is first that you need to actually be able to recall the mediator when you're prompted with the foreign language word, and secondly that once you recall it, it can get you to the English translation. And so we evaluated the extent to which testing actually leads to the formation of these more effective mediators, and we did find support for this.
In particular, Pick and Rawson found that if they just prompted participants with the Swahili word, those who had self-tested, in addition to restudying, did better on the final test. If they prompted participants with the Swahili word and asked them to recall their own mediator word before coming up with the English translation, again, those who self-tested, in addition to restudying, did better on the final test. If they prompted participants with the Swahili word and also gave them their own mediator, again, those who had self-tested, in addition to restudying, did better on the final test. And curiously, Pink says, prompting self-testers either to recall their own mediator or just giving it to them didn't really change their scores compared to self-testers who just got the Swahili word.
So these people are already retrieving these mediators when they have a test trial, and it's helping them get to the correct target answer, whereas people in the restudy group aren't.
Roddy Roediger, who researches memory at Washington University in St. Louis and is not affiliated with the study, says the results are also an example of what's called transfer-appropriate processing.
The idea is, what's your criterial task? What are you going to need to do? And if you know what you will eventually need to do, that helps to guide the way you should study.
So, Roediger says, if your test is to remember the English translation of a Swahili word, then you should study by giving yourself a translation test.
If people use these mediators, they would learn the vocabulary of the language much faster than they do doing the usual things. And I believe that the whole idea of retrieval practice or testing is a generally efficient study strategy. You just need to adapt it to what you'll have to do. So it's more general than just language learning. It's any time you have a you know, associative pair of information you need to learn.
Such as the associative pair of, say, a person's face with his or her name. You can use mediators for that, too. But as both Roedinger and Pick point out, there may be many reasons why those who did self-testing scored better in the final test, including simply their comfort level with being tested. Again, study author Mary Pick.
Within mediator use itself, you know, the strength of the mediator could be increased from testing, or you could see perhaps shifting of mediators, and that leads to the formation of more effective ones. So there's many, many questions to be answered still. So we've kind of taken the first step in terms of looking at these particular encoding strategies.
You can read Pick's paper, Why Testing Improves Memory, the Mediator Effectiveness Hypothesis, in this week's Science.
Medicines that are based on nanoparticles are beginning to make an impact in the clinic. They're beginning to be tested on real patients and have an effect on real lives.
Science's Robert Service reports in this week's issue on experimental cancer treatments that evade the body's immune system and can deliver a higher concentration of toxic chemotherapy drugs to cancer cells.
Traditional oncology drugs can be highly toxic to normal cells, and it sets up this toxicity that a lot of us are probably familiar with, of friends or family who have gone through cancer therapy. The therapy itself can be very damaging and dangerous for patients. And that's the toxicity of the drugs. So one of the advantages that nanoparticles have is that they can put those chemotherapeutic agents on the inside of a nanoparticle and shield them from the rest of the body and thereby protect normal cells from their effects. So a single molecule of a anti-cancer compound is extremely small, and it can leak out the side of blood vessels and thereby affect normal tissues. Nanoparticles, by comparison, are massive. Even though they're small on a human scale, they're much larger, so they can't readily just pass out of the bloodstream and affect normal tissues. Now, cancer tissues, in most cancers, as they begin to grow, they have to form new blood vessels in order for the tumor to get bigger and bigger. In that process, the blood vessels aren't normally as good. They often are leaky. They have holes in them. So the nanoparticles can leak out into the tumor tissue. So you can target nanomedicines to cancer cells in different ways. You can do it just by having them leak out of the leaky blood vessels. So that's one way. But you can specifically put a compound on the outside of a nanomedicine to try to get it to bind to specifically to one type of a cancer cell. And that's how some of the advanced nanomedicines are beginning. Researchers are now beginning to incorporate those kind of address labels, if you will, on their medicines to have their medicines target specific tissues and specific cell types.
And what is it about the insides of cancer cells that would cause these nanoparticles to release their contents as compared with regular cells?
Right, that's a good question. It depends on how you design your nanoparticle. So researchers, when they design them, they know that the environment of the bloodstream is different than the environment of an inside of a cell. So most tumor cells have a pretty acidic environment. And so researchers will design their nanoparticles so that they're stable at the pH or the acidity level in the bloodstream. But once they get into a more acidic environment, that will begin to break down the outside of the shells of these particles when they'll release their drugs.
Now, you said at the start that these medicines are starting to have an impact. Is that because they're finally making it through clinical trials or because of some new innovation?
Some of them have made it all the way through clinical trials, and actually that was the first round of them, the first generation, if you will, made it through a few years ago. These tended to be simpler particles. So one example is a particle that uses a protein that we all have in our bloodstream called albumin, and the researchers designed their particles so it would have a bunch of albumin molecules, was essentially shield the anti-cancer compound and then allow it to get into the cells, and then it would fall apart in there and do its work. So the second generation, or a second generation of particles, is now moving into the clinic, into clinical trials, and those tend to have different outer shells of the nanoparticles, which researchers have designed to be, in some cases, more stable and, you know, have different properties to them that allow them to target different cells or reach different parts of the body. So most of these are not yet into the marketplace. Most of them are in early stage clinical trials. There's about a dozen early stage clinical trials.
So it sounds like these nanomedicines are getting increased concentrations of known cancer treating drugs into tumor cells.
That's right, yeah.
Is there anything else these nanomedicine strategies are enabling?
Yeah, you can not only put an anti-cancer agent in there, you can also put an imaging agent on the inside of the particle. So if your nanomedicines make it to a tumor tissue, it can then be used to essentially light up that tissue in an imaging study, like an MRI or something like that. And that way, clinicians can follow. They can not only see where the cancer might be, but then they can track the progress of therapy to see if it's working and the tumors are shrinking. And another way nanoparticles might prove valuable is with a sort of a new generation of therapies called RNA antisense therapies. And this has been a topic that's been a very hot topic in the scientific literature now for a decade or so. Here, the goal is you can use tiny fragments of RNA, which cells of all kinds use RNA to help build proteins. So what the hope in this field for some time has been is, well, can you actually inject into cells little fragments of RNA that will actually bind to the natural RNA fragments and prevent those from ever getting translated into proteins? So if you do that to a cancer cell, can you actually kill those cancer cells because they can't build the proteins they need to survive? That's been a long dream, and there's been a number of clinical trials that have actually failed. Now, a number of groups are packaging these RNAs inside nanoparticles and using the same strategies to try to get those into tumor cells and then have them release their cargo once there and hopefully kill tumor cells. So some of these therapies have also just now entered the clinic. And so there's great hope in the nanomedicine field that nanoparticles could reinvigorate, if you will, the field of RNA therapies.
As researchers construct these nanomedicines, are they using them in any other ways than as delivery mechanisms for other drugs?
Well, besides putting the therapeutics on the inside and the imaging agents on the inside, researchers are also learning a lot about what happens when you make different kinds of nanoparticles of different sizes or shapes, and that actually is turning out to be potentially clinically useful as well. So in one example, a team has been able to show that if you make a nanoparticle that actually is shaped like a pathogenic bacteria, particular cells in the body will readily take it up because they might think it's a bacteria and they want to try to engulf it and wipe it out. So one way this might be used, and it's actually a clinical trial is getting ready to be started on this, is a company is shaping nanoparticles to look like these pathogenic bacteria, but the nanoparticles have on the inside of them proteins that are on the outside of a flu virus. And these proteins are the normal ones that are used in flu vaccines already. But the hope is that you might be able to just give a single injection of a flu vaccine and you wouldn't need to use as much of it. And you would get a very high antibody response and a very high response of your body against the proteins to knock out the flu. And therefore, potentially, you could make your vaccines quite cheaper and you could therefore treat a lot more people for less money.
Bob Service, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Science's Bob Service reports in this week's issue on experimental cancer treatments that evade the body's immune system and can deliver a higher concentration of toxic chemotherapy drugs to cancer cells. Also in this week's Science, modeling protein folding. It takes so much computing power to simulate all the motions of a protein's constituent atoms and surrounding water molecules that it's not been feasible for scientists to model the complete folding process of even the smallest proteins. And that's even though the conformational changes in proteins that scientists would like to model occur very quickly, between 10 microseconds and 1 millisecond. There are just too many interactions, even in those timeframes. But in a paper in this week's Science, David Shaw and colleagues report that their custom-built supercomputer speeds up calculations to the extent that the team can simulate protein folding over periods 100 times longer than previously feasible, making molecular dynamic simulations long enough to reveal biological processes. Read the paper, Atomic Level Characterization of the Structural Dynamics of Proteins, and a related news story in this week's Science. When you sprain your ankle, hurt your back, or, say, accidentally slam your fingers in a door, your immune system responds by sending neutrophils, a type of white blood cell, to the injury. That leads to redness, heat, swelling, and can cause even more pain. And sometimes the immune system overreacts, and the inflammation itself can cause much further injury, even death. In a paper in this week's Science, Paul Koobs and colleagues report that several molecular signals guide the neutrophils through the circulatory system to the location of the injury. These molecular signals include peptides released from mitochondria within the damaged cells, signals that the authors suggest could be targets for new anti-inflammatory drugs to limit the damage caused by the immune system's overexuberant response. I spoke with Koobs from his office at the University of Calgary.
So we were very interested in trying to understand how the immune system and white cells recognize injury that is not necessarily an infectious injury, so not caused by bacteria, not caused by viruses, but just a sterile injury, something like a swollen ankle, something like stroke, something like following a kidney transplant. Injury occurs in those systems. The white cells infiltrate, and they may cause more injury. We wanted to understand, how do they get there?
What in the literature so far is known about how those cells get there?
So there's a growing body of literature over the last year that suggests that perhaps danger signals, signals released from dying cells, attract the neutrophils, or the white cells, in this case the neutrophils, into these sites. And so we were beginning to understand that there's something called danger signals or alarmins that cause an alarm that tells our immune system there's a problem, we need to get our white cells there.
And which cells were you and your team looking at to study this neutrophil recruitment?
Well, so we were looking actually in the liver, and we were actually injuring the basic cell of the liver, the hepatocyte. We were actually causing it to lyse because we applied a heat injury, and the hepatocytes lysed, and now we watched the neutrophils crawl through the blood vessels to that site of injury. And they can crawl right against the bloodstream, right into that area, and then do what they're supposed to do.
Now, as I understand from your paper, you had previously reported that in vitro, you've seen how this happens. So now you and your team have observed this happening in vivo. Is that right?
So we had previously done a very simple experiment where we asked, actually, does a neutrophil decide between chasing after our own signals, okay, so signals that it sees when the danger signals are released, versus if it was to chase after, for example, bacteria. And we found that the neutrophil always decides to chase after bacteria. And so the bacteria must have something that tells the neutrophil, this is the most important thing for you to chase after. Okay, and that's what we had done in vitro. So it wasn't sterile injury. It was an injury that you might see without any bacteria. But it gave us some idea that maybe the same kind of cues might happen when a dead cell ruptures and releases certain danger signals.
So was there some new imaging technique then that you and your team developed to see this neutrophil recruitment happening in vivo?
Yeah. So what we had to do was we had to be able to distinguish the neutrophils from every other kind of cell. And so we used a new imaging technique that allowed us to see just glowing green neutrophils. Okay. And so we used a mouse that actually had its neutrophils glowing green. And then we were able to show dead and dying cells in the body using a glowing red signal. And so now we could watch the green neutrophils go towards the dying red dead cells, if you will. Also, we were able to label the blood vessels in a blue color. And so now we could see whether the green neutrophils were running through the tissue, or were they actually staying in the blood vessels and going towards the dying cells through the blood vessels. And the whole thing was imaged with a spinning disc microscopy, which isn't a new technique, but it is being applied now to an intact mouse, so we could actually look in vivo and see all of this happening in a real live tissue.
So what exactly was happening? How were the neutrophils getting to the site of inflammation?
So the first thing we saw was that the cells, within the first couple of minutes, stopped around the injury site, probably quite a ways away. And then what they did was they started sensing that there was something wrong, and they all started crawling towards this site. Okay? And when they reached a certain area, they now started racing towards this site because they knew there was a real problem. And the signal or the cue that actually told them there were dying cells there was a real surprise to us. It ended up being actually a molecule that's made by bacteria, even though we didn't have any bacteria in this system. So this really puzzled us. How was this happening? Well, mitochondria, which are really the energy plants of our cells, they make lots and lots of energy and allow our cells to live, are actually endosymbionts. What that means is they are ancient, ancient bacteria that crawled into cells millions and millions of years ago and now have a symbiotic relationship with our cells. And so the mitochondria were actually releasing bacterial products. They were actually saying, hey, there's an injury here. We're releasing these peptides, these products, and our white cells thought, uh-oh, there's some sort of infection there, and they went racing there. So in fact, we fool our immune system into believing there's a bacterial infection, and that's how we get them to sites of injury.
And they travel through the bloodstream?
They travel through the bloodstream, they get to the site, and then they go racing in there. And I think a part of this is to clean up the mess. A part of it is to try and get rid of any dead cells and allow new cells to start growing. But a part of it may be inappropriate. There may be too many of these neutrophils running in, and they may be causing too much injury. The best example of that is a swollen ankle. You know, there's injury there, and so your ankle swells, but if you take a little bit of ibuprofen and prevent all that swelling, you feel a lot better and you get healed a lot faster than if you didn't take the ibuprofen. And so we think that the white cell, the neutrophil, if we could regulate or reduce how much get in there, we could probably limit the collateral injury. And so we think that this new bacterial peptides are potentially a new form of anti-inflammatory, if you will, and perhaps have some therapeutic potential.
Is the same mechanism in neutrophil recruitment involved when there's damage to other cell types?
So as far as we know, we have looked in skin, and under those conditions, if you have a burn, for example, in skin, we saw a very similar pattern of injury. Now, in the brain, for example, during traumatic brain injury, we know neutrophils are recruited. We don't know what the mechanisms are, and that's actually what we're looking at right now.
So basic research then to help people understand how better to treat these sorts of inflammations?
Yeah. I think that there are many, many patients in hospitals who are being harmed by excessive inflammation. And if we could find ways of limiting that inflammation, we would go a long way towards reducing a lot of the suffering that goes on. And I think that some of these potentially new anti-inflammatory molecules, or at least developing new anti-inflammatory molecules to find better ways of reducing inflammation, is really where the clinical significance of this paper lies.
Will you have to tweak your imaging technique in order to see around these different cell types?
So we have this microscope that will allow us to visualize almost any tissue we want. If we want to go deeper into tissues, if we want to look deep into the brain, we might need to use a slightly different microscopy technique, but we have those microscopes and we have access to those microscopes as well. So we believe we'll be able to visualize a lot of this in most of the tissues that we're interested in.
Paul Koobs, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Robert, for calling.
Paul Koobs of the University of Calgary is senior author of a paper on the intravascular danger signals that guide neutrophils to sites of sterile inflammation. Finally today, David Graham, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about pessimistic dogs. How do they measure that, Dave?
Well, Rob, what they do is they put dogs in a room and they put them behind a screen that they can see through. And they stick a bowl at one of two sides of the room. If it's on one side, it always has food in it. If it's on the other side, it never has food in it. And then they let the dog go. And after a series of trials, the dogs come to realize, hey, if the bowl's, say, always on the left side of the room, it's going to have food. And if it's always on the right side of the room, it's going to be empty. And then what they do is they start mixing things up a little bit. They start putting the bowl maybe in the middle of the room, and then they let the dogs go. And the dogs that rush towards that bowl are considered optimistic because they go, well, I don't know if this has food or not, but I'm hoping that it does. But other dogs just sort of sigh or lay down or maybe very slowly make their way to that other bowl, indicating that they're pessimistic, that they believe that that bowl probably doesn't have food in it and it's not worth their time. And actually, researchers use very similar things, though not with food in bowls. They use very similar experiments to test whether humans are optimistic or pessimistic.
Why are researchers trying to figure out whether dogs are pessimistic or not?
Great question. Well, the reason is because researchers actually want to find out why about a third of dogs become very anxious when their owners leave home. You probably heard this. If you have a dog or if your neighbor has a dog, you leave for the day and your dog starts whining, or while you're away at work, your dog pees on the floor or tears up your slippers. These are considered anxious behaviors because the dog's very stressed out, very worried that you're gone. And the researchers in this study wanted to see if they could find a way to predict whether shelter dogs, dogs that get adopted, will be also these anxious dogs that misbehave when their owners are away.
So could researchers tell with just this one test whether a dog from a shelter would have behavioral problems after being adopted?
Well, the first thing researchers found was that they could tell whether, or at least they say they could tell whether a dog was optimistic or pessimistic. But in the next set of experiments, they wanted to find out whether that correlated with these dogs also being anxious. So they took the same dogs and they stuck them in a room alone as if they had gone away for the day. And what happened, as you might expect, is a certain fraction of the dogs became very anxious. They barked, they whined. The researchers found that these anxious dogs also tended to be the dogs that were judged to be pessimistic by the other experiment. So they conclude based on that, that pessimistic dogs or dogs that tend to have maybe a negative outlook on life also tend to be anxious dogs.
Did researchers investigate any other traits?
Well, not in this study, Rob, but one outside expert points out that this study may be not a simple black and white between optimistic and pessimistic. He thinks dogs actually have very complex personalities, maybe not as complex as we do, but much more complex than just saying a dog is optimistic and pessimistic. He thinks what's actually happening here is the dogs that are being called pessimistic are actually neurotic, which is a much more complex trait, which involves elements of pessimism and anxiety. But there's a lot more going on when you call somebody or some animal neurotic than if you just call it optimistic or pessimistic. So he says, you know, it's a cool study. It shows this link that we didn't know before, but it also shows something about dog personality that we didn't really know before.
Sounds like a really simple test. Is this something that somebody could set up in their own home?
Well, I think you could probably set up the optimism pessimism test in your own home, but I think the neuroticism would be a little bit harder to test.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, pessimism is often described as seeing the glass of water half empty. And speaking of water, this next story is all about water being a lot more complicated than we thought.
How so?
Well, our researchers already knew on some level that water is actually pretty complicated. Water can form 15 different kinds of ice. It's necessary for all life on Earth, meaning that water was very important for the first proteins forming, for DNA forming. Every living creature would not be here without water. So we know, you know, despite water's reputation as being sort of a dull liquid, it's actually a very important and potentially a very complicated liquid. But on the molecular level, we really don't have a good sense of what's going on. So in this new study, researchers really wanted to probe down to the molecular interactions that happen between water molecules. And they did this by doing a computer simulation, and they used the same sort of mathematical models that researchers have used to study other very complicated systems like the internet or the spread of viruses. And what they found is that even though water seems pretty ordinary on the surface, there's actually a sort of molecular party going on at the atomic level. What these researchers saw was that water molecules tend to form two types of molecular structures. One's this blobby, loosely packed agglomeration, and the other one is this tight, regular arrangement resembling a crystal lattice. But these structures only exist for fractions of a second, femtoseconds, Rob, which is essentially very, very, very short time scales. And What was happening in these femtosecond timescales is these structures are forming, they're breaking apart. The end result is this really chaotic mix of water molecules. And it's not just this chaotic mix, is there's really sort of other unusual structures forming in these fractions and fractions of a second. You've got the hydrogen atoms in water, as everybody knows, water is two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom, forming something that almost looks like a hook onto which carbon, which is essential for all life and part of DNA and proteins and everything else, can potentially latch onto, which would give simple structures the scaffolding to become much more complicated structures and eventually complex organic molecules.
So it's thought this natural jostling of water molecules would actually help complex organic molecules form.
Exactly.
Why a computer model? Why not visualize it directly?
It's really hard to study something that happens so quickly in the real world, and that's why the researchers needed these really complex simulations. But that's actually one of the critiques of the work, is that, you know, these researchers may be oversimplifying things by just studying these water molecules with a computer model, and you're really not going to know what's going on with water until we're actually able to observe the water molecules themselves rather than just representing them on a computer. But it's a start.
Okay, so last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, speaking of water, this last story is about creatures that live in water, fish, and how the rate at which fish decay could be very important for understanding evolution.
Different fish decay at different rates?
Well, it's not necessarily that different fish decay at different rates, but it's that different parts of a fish decay at different rates. Rob, the study has all to do with some of the challenges in looking at the fossil record. You know, archaeologists, scientists, they look at the fossil record. They trace the evolution of creatures over millions of years by looking at what, you know, new structures that are appearing in these creatures or structures that are disappearing. But the problem is a lot of a creature's original anatomy doesn't fossilize. It's really only the bones that fossilize. The soft tissues like skin and nerves, muscles, things like that, they don't fossilize. So if you're looking at an ancient creature and you're going, well, it seems to be missing this, this, and this part, well, maybe it wasn't. Maybe it's just that those parts didn't fossilize. So that's been a really big challenge. And this new study researcher said, well, you know, one of the really important things that we study in evolutionary biology is fish, because fish have changed so much and they really give us clues to how more complicated organisms may have evolved. And so what they did, which they themselves admit was a very stinky experiment, was they took two types of fish and watched them decay.
Which two fish did they choose and why?
Well, Rob, they focused on lampreys and hagfish. And the reason they focused on these fish is these fish are actually thought to be amongst the most primitive forms of fish. They may tell us a lot about what fish used to look like, or at least what these classes of fish used to look like millions of years ago. So they took the fish out of the water, they put them in the laboratory, and they basically allowed them to decay for 200 days.
That does sound stinky.
Exactly. And one of the researchers says he didn't get very many visitors to his lab during these experiments.
So what did they find?
Well, what the researchers found was, as they expected, a lot of these parts of the fish decayed very rapidly. Some structures completely disappeared over this 200-day period. And if you're trying to tie that to the fossil record, if these fish were somehow fossilized, all of a sudden, you know, somebody studying these fish millions of years from now would go, well, hey, that fish didn't have X, Y, and Z structure. And in fact, what happened is these structures just very quickly decayed. For example, certain parts of their brain and their mouths decayed. And you can imagine these are very important structures for understanding how a creature evolved.
Did researchers pick up any patterns between the two different types of fish and how they respectively decayed?
Well, they did find that certain parts decayed much faster than the other. And in fact, the parts that decayed the fastest were those parts that had evolved the most recently. And so again, you could be dealing with real problems if you're trying to interpret the fossil record, and the parts that you're most concerned about, you know, when did this part evolve, it's missing, and you just assume it hadn't evolved yet. So the main point is that we have to be very careful when we look at the fossil record. Just because the structure is not there doesn't mean it hadn't evolved yet.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about how love fights pain, how just thinking about somebody you care about can reduce physical pain. And also a story about wacky pitches in baseball, curveballs and other types of balls that seem to suddenly change direction in midair. Researchers have analyzed what they say is just an optical illusion. And on Science's policy blog, Science Insider, we've got a story about the first embryonic stem cell trial starting in the United States. This trial is to treat spinal cord injury, and the researchers have just recruited their first patient. And another origin story, this one about a super laser that's just beginning its experiments. You can check out all of these stories on the site.
David Graham is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the October 15th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. Thanks to Sophia Kai for her help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.